Ebola estimates just keep going up and up.
The effect of enhanced information on the use of prenatal genetic testing.
Varicose vein treatment.
And the accuracy of PET scans for diagnosing lung cancer in areas where there's infectious lung disease.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on September 26th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
In the same place, I would add. So, of course, Ebola is occupying a lot of attention all over. I guess in some respects, I have to apologize to our listeners that we continue to talk about it, although it's unclear to me how we would possibly avoid it. This, of course, is a worldwide problem. And now with these upwardly revised, and I would say dramatically upwardly revised estimates of the number of people who are likely to become infected, it's even more of a concern. That's from data from MMWR, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report from the CDC.
It was first reported on March 22nd of 2014 with the initial report of 49 cases in Guinea. By the beginning of this month, there were almost 4,000 probable, confirmed, or suspected cases in West Africa, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. What the CDC attempted to do was to estimate the future number of cases in this particular Ebola epidemic. And they used current numbers, the infection rate, and also looked at what would happen if we don't increase the ability to hospitalize these patients or to isolate these patients. It looks like the numbers of cases of Ebola are doubling every 20 to 30 days. If there's no additional interventions, that Liberia and Sierra Leone will have approximately 500,000 Ebola cases by January of 2015. And by the way, that only represents a total reported cases of about 1.4 million that are actually currently there.
These are really, really frightening numbers. I think they reflect a couple of things that are worth revisiting. We know that there are plenty of people now who are avoiding coming into the healthcare system because they are so afraid of infection in that venue.
The other thing this study highlights is if we can get 70% of the suspected Ebola virus cases into either a hospitalized situation or into a community setting where the individuals are isolated and there's safe burial practices, we can stem this epidemic. Not everybody has to be hospitalized. But you're right, for those that remain in the community, the typical burial practices, for example, in northern Uganda, is that the body is prepared by a relative, usually a paternal aunt or some other female on the paternal side of the family. They remove the clothes from the body, the body's washed, and then the family members touch the individual on the face. This is referred to as love touch, and they wash their hands in a communal bucket. So this exposes all the individuals. And unless we can either change the practice of getting people acute care or change the community setting, this epidemic is going to continue to grow.
And of course, we have no data yet on a vaccine or the vaccine that's under testing right now.
And that will take some time. It doesn't address people that are already infected.
We'll be watching. We know we're going to hear more about it. Let's turn to something else that I think is really pretty prominent right now on lots of people's radar. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Some years ago now, we reported that, wow, we can use spiral CT to identify people who are former smokers who are at high risk to develop lung cancer. Wow. And then subsequent studies showed, we're going to be looking at a lot of lesions that may or may not have turned out to be problematic, that old specter of overdiagnosis. Now there's another nuance to this whole argument.
And in fact, in lesions that are identified by CT scan, as you described, especially in high-risk patients, if there's a question about whether this could be a cancerous lesion or not, people are referred for additional testing. And that usually involves doing a positron emission tomography scan or a PET scan combined with FDG, that's fluorodeoxyglucose. We give this particular agent, and cancer lesions have a high uptake. It carries, in general, an accuracy of 90 to 94%. People that live along the Mississippi River are more prone to develop fungal infections over the course of their lifetime, things like histoplasmosis or blasto. People that live in the southwestern part of the United States are more likely to be exposed to fungus called coccidiomycosis, and it can also form lung nodules. So the real question is, if you take these endemic areas, is PET scan just as accurate in diagnosing a lesion as being malignant as compared to being benign. And that's what this study examined. They looked at all the studies conducted from 2000 to 2014. They looked at the sensitivity and specificity of FDG PET scan in diagnosing lung cancer. And they were able to identify 70 studies that did this. There were a total of 8,500 nodules identified. About 60% were malignant. And what they found was when this test was applied to individuals in whom the infectious disease was endemic, the specificity was only 61%. It's about a 50-50 flip of the coin whether it really is benign or malignant in individuals that live in these endemic areas.
Very interesting. Once again, suggesting that this personalized medicine approach is really the only way to go, and we need to be aware of all of these kinds of factors that might impact on tests such as this one.
Absolutely. And the authors make the point is this shouldn't be a routine screening in these areas unless we can prove it's as good in these areas as it is in non-endemic areas.
Okay. I think that's something worth taking home and employing. Let's turn to another type of therapy then, or actually, let's turn to another type of testing that has had some additional nuance added to it this week. Again, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, what happens when you inform pregnant women about prenatal testing?
So, Elizabeth, I'm going to take a step out on a limb now, and I'm going to say, if you were pregnant, would you want prenatal testing, and what kind would you want?
And so I will reveal that when I was pregnant, I had CVS, chorionic villus sampling, and that was okay for me at that point.
So it was okay for you. Would it be okay for everybody?
I think that that's a personal determination.
All right. And that personal determination can only be made if the woman has the facts. What type of testing is available? What are the results of the testing? How accurate is it? What are the risks and benefits of it? Can you provide that information? And then once you do that, how does it affect the use of testing, especially if you made testing free? So what this study attempted to do was to address this particular issue. It was a randomized trial conducted over a three-year period from 2010 to 2013, where they took a look at over 700 women that were pregnant, and half of them were randomized to this computerized interactive decision support guide. After that, they were given prenatal testing with no out-of-pocket expenses. And what this guy did was it talked about what the risks were, the various ways of having prenatal testing, what are the risks and benefits, what it may tell you, what it may not tell you. And in those that received this computerized interactive decision support guide, they were actually less likely to undergo invasive testing. 50% less likely. At the end of 24 weeks, they asked, how do you feel about this? The women who had decision support actually felt very good about their decision and didn't regret it.
Well, now there's some good news, because that buyer's remorse kind of thing is definitely a factor. It would be terrible to think about a woman completing her pregnancy, always sort of wondering in the back of her head, should I have done this? Of course, I'm in favor of providing this kind of information. I think everybody needs to be completely informed about risks and benefits before they choose anything, whatever that intervention is.
This shows that you can do it effectively. Now, this program took about 45 to 60 minutes, but it didn't involve a healthcare person directly involved. So it didn't take somebody's time. I think this goes a long ways to not only personalizing medicine, but also telling us how we can better inform our patients.
I like it. Finally, then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. That very common problem, varicose veins, people have been struggling for many, many years, decades, in fact, with how best to treat those.
And Elizabeth, although this isn't a life-threatening condition, as you say, it's problematic. We've only talked about this one other time in the 9 years that we've been recording. It was a randomized trial that compared different treatments for varicose veins, foam sclerotherapy, that is injecting foam into the area, doing laser therapy, or three is performing surgery. Almost 800 participants were randomized to one of those three treatment arms. Was there any difference in quality of life 6 months after therapy between the three therapies? What they discovered was, overall, the general quality of life was the same regardless of therapy. What was the complication rate? The procedural complication rate was lowest in the laser group, about 1% versus 6 or 7% with foam therapy or surgery. When they looked at how effective it was in completely ablating the varicose veins, the laser and surgery were better than the foam therapy.
And sounds like in toto, though, that the laser appeared to be the best strategy.
It did. Now, in fairness, with both the foam and the laser therapy, at the end of 6 weeks, if it wasn't as effective, then a second therapy could be applied. A third of the patients that had laser therapy ultimately needed an injection of foam. That was the same, by the way, for those that started with foam therapy as well. But I agree with you. This study suggests to me that laser therapy is as effective as the other types, has a lower complication rate, and a very good ablation rate or complete succession rate.
That's, of course, very good news for the multitude of people who develop varicose veins in their lifetime, and it is a very large number.
So, Elizabeth, which of these studies do you want to highlight on our blog this week?
I wrote about Ebola last week, so I'm not going to write about Ebola again. So I'm going to let you choose between these other three studies. Which one do you think I should pontificate about?
Let's do the one about prenatal genetic testing. One of the things that I like about our podcast, what we do, is we try to inform our listeners so they can make good decisions. And so I like this particular study.
Okay. Of course, El Presidente, I will do your will. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.